welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Monday, September 28th, 2015. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, Kim Hecox will be here to highlight his new book, Jimmy Bluefeather. Pat Race, Bruce Botello, and Cindy Spaniers will be here with a preview of Wednesday's forum on Alaska's fiscal future. We'll get an update on Perseverance Theater's current production, The Tragedy of Othello, and we'll hear about activities at the City Museum, those interviews, National Native News Writers Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more right here on a Juneau afternoon. Currently 54 degrees at the Juneau Airport, 56 in Hoonah, and 54 degrees in Gustavus.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Ho-Chunk Nation in Wisconsin has added a Rights of Nature Declaration to its constitution. Chuck Kornbach of Wisconsin Public Radio reports the tribe's concerned about protecting ceremonial grounds and other lands.
Ho-Chunk tribal member William Greendeer says he's been concerned about sand mines, cranberry growers, and other companies cutting down large numbers of trees and causing other environmental damage near native sites.
You know, these trees have a right to live, just as much as everybody else. And, you know, it's the corporations that have been pushing a lot of the destruction on the earth. It had to be a wake-up call of some sort.
Greendeer says the Ho-Chunk believe other parts of nature, including air, water, and wildlife, also have rights. He hopes a Rights of Nature statement the tribe recently approved adding to its constitution will provide the Ho-Chunk with more legal standing to protect natural resources. Julie De La Terre is an adjunct professor at Viterbo University in Wisconsin. She's been helping the Ho-Chunk with the Rights of Nature Declaration. De La Terre says modern law allows too much exploitation of nature.
It doesn't allow for nature to be made whole. So that's the point of the Ho-Chunks incorporating this, is it's allowing nature to be made whole and for nature to be protected by giving a voice through a human intervener like a lawyer that can talk on behalf of the oak trees and the water systems and everything else. That's how this is supposed to work.
De La Terre says the Rights of Nature concept has had legal success in South America. The Ho-Chunk Nation says it may find out soon whether the resolution will hold up in U.S. federal courts. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
Canada has won the World Cup of Indoor Lacrosse. They beat the national team of the six Iroquois nations. As North Country Public Radio's David Summerstein reports, the Iroquois were hoping a home crowd would help them take the gold.
The Iroquois Nationals largely sailed through the preliminary rounds, ending with a convincing 17-4 victory over the Czech Republic. The Nationals are led by the four Thompson brothers from Onondaga. Shelley Burnham Shognosh, a fan from Six Nations in Canada, says the Thompsons are ambassadors for the sport that was created by the Iroquois.
It's incredible that four brothers could be playing on a team, and the excitement of them being very traditional young men. They are excellent role models for our kids.
This marks the first time an Indigenous territory has hosted a major international championship. The Iroquois Nationals are hoping they can finally defeat their nemesis, Canada, who's taken the gold the last three times. The final match is Sunday afternoon. For National Native News, I'm David Summerstein on the Onondaga Nation.
Native American advocate Jess Sixkiller was fatally shot last week in Phoenix, Arizona. The 78-year-old was killed during a home invasion. Family members told local television stations Friday that Sixkiller had long fought for Native American rights and was also one of the first Native Americans to serve on the Chicago police force. Family members say the tragedy happened as his wife of more than 50 years has been battling cancer. Police are asking for help from the public for information on the case. New Mexico schools are among those to receive grants from the U.S. Department of Education, which announced awards last week to help Native youth with college and careers. The Native American Community Academy Foundation was awarded $2 million to help five schools. The funds will include helping Pueblo and Navajo students in the state. Based on a model pioneered by the Native American Community Academy in Albuquerque, the schools focus on preparing and encouraging Native students to attend college and promotes Native culture, language, and community. The grant will help with school startup services, a Native college prep course, school leadership support, performance management, and financial and operational support. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation. with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. For 45 years, NARF has stood firm for justice in Indian country on critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior. Stand firm with NARF. Learn more at NARF.org and join the fight for Native rights. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to A June Afternoon here on Monday, September 28th, 2015. Scott Burton, your host, and joining me now in the studio is author, photographer, musician, and climate change activist, Mr. Kim Hecox. Welcome to the show, Kim.
Thank you, Scott.
Did I get all of your hats?
Oh, let me check. I think so.
All right. Welcome to the show. In his hands, hot off the press, is his new novel, Jimmy Bluefeather. He's going to be doing a signing of that tonight at the Hearthside Nugget Mall from 5 to 7, did you say, Kim?
That's right, yeah.
All right, and here on the show today, he's going to read for us and all of that. How long have you lived in Gustavus, Kim?
I arrived in 1979 as a park ranger at Glacier Bay National Monument before it became a national park in 1980. I arrived in 1979.
And I suspect if somebody's been to Gustavus or if they've been to Glacier Bay National Park, they can understand how you fell in love with that area.
I did. I fell in love with the place. I fell in love with Melanie Newman. I met and married her there. She was a fellow park ranger. We married there. Found a beautiful community of friends. So I like to say I came because of the place, but I stayed because of the people. It's a great community.
Okay. How many books have you written now?
I think about a dozen, okay. 10 or 12. I don't keep count, really.
And tell us a few titles that we may be familiar with.
Well, The Only Kayak, 2005, a memoir about living in Southeast Alaska, Glacier Bay, Icy Strait area, falling in love with Alaska and making a home here. That book is now, I think, in its 11th or 12th printing.
Okay.
And then, in the last 20 months, I'm having 4 books published. It's just this massive breaking wave. I went 9 years after The Only Kayak of nothing getting published.
Any explanation for that?
No, I worked on a book called, no single explanation. I worked on a book called Fixing a Hole in the Ocean about living in Alaska, and it just didn't hold together, so I had to kill it. I had to burn it. 6 years of work. But I took some of the best pieces of that book and put them in a memoir about my relationship to Denali National Park called Rhythm of the Wild. It came out in May. It's done quite well. And I think success breeds success once one big book gets picked up. And the first of these 4 that got published was John Muir and the Ice That Started the Fire in April of 2014, a biography of John Muir's time in Alaska. And it did well. And then the dam began to break. Other publishers wanted to pick up my other books. Here we are.
Okay. So this is a novel, a work of fiction, Jimmy Bluefeather. What was the inspiration for this book?
Well, this book is about an old 95, he doesn't really know how old he is, about 95-year-old Tlingit Norwegian man living in the Icy Strait region, loosely based on Huna. And he's a former canoe carver, but hasn't carved his last canoe in over 50 years. Raised largely by his uncle on his mother's side. And he's in constant pain, and he thinks he wants to die. Then his grandson, the youngest son of his youngest daughter, a promising basketball player, ruins his leg in a logging accident and says to his grandpa, in a bitter moment, I might as well be dead. I have nothing left to live for. And it snaps the old man out of his trance and gives him something to work for. So teach his grandson to become a new artist. Let his hands become his new legs. I was inspired to do this story because it's loosely based on Glacier Bay, and that's the homeland, of course, of the Huna Tlingit. And I thought, what if the oldest man in town carved a canoe and went back in the old way? Boy, And what if everybody started looking for him and they couldn't find him? Because all of his youthful senses come back into play. Once he's on the water, he becomes young again, and he's very clever. And he's likable. I wanted to create a story with an endearing, enduring character. I really strove to create an Atticus Finch, like To Kill a Mockingbird, a great central character. And I was so pleased when Nancy Lord in We Alaskans in Alaska Dispatch News just compared this book to Kill a Mockingbird. Yeah.
Would you read from it for us?
Yes, let me just read the very beginning. The Weight of Air is the first chapter. Used to be it was hard to live and easy to die. Not anymore. Nowadays it was the other way around. Old Keb shook his head as he shuffled down the forest trail, thinking that he thought too much. Oi, he muttered, his voice a moan from afar. He prodded the rain-soaked earth with his alder walking cane. For a moment his old weathered hand caught his attention, the way his bones fitted to the wood, the wilderness between his fingers, the space where Bessie's hand used to be. Wet ferns brushed his pants in a familiar way. He turned his head to get his bearings as only his one eye worked. The other was about as useful as a marble and not so pretty to look at. It had quit working long ago and sat there hitching a ride in his wrinkled face. The doctors had offered to patch it or plug it or toss it out the last time old Keb was in Seattle, but he said no. Someday it might start working again, and he didn't want to do all his seeing out of one side of his head. He was a man, for God's sake, not a halibut. A wind corkscrew through the tall hemlocks. Old Keb stopped to listen, but had problems here, too. He could stand next to a hot chainsaw and think it was an egg beater. All his ears did now was collect dirt and wax and grow crooked hairs of such girth and length as to make people think that they were the only vigorous parts of his anatomy. He always fell asleep with his glasses on, halfway down his nose. He said he could see his dreams better that way. The dreams of bears when he remembered, when his bones remembered, waking up in the winter of his life. Nobody knew how old he was, not even old Keb. He might have known once, but couldn't remember. Somewhere around 95 was his guess, a guess he didn't share with any of his children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren, or the legions of cousins, nephews, nieces, friends, and doctors who figured he was close to 100 and were on a holy crusade to keep him alive. All his old friends were dead, the ones he'd grown up with and made stories with. He'd outlived them all. He'd outlived himself.
Well, thank you for sharing.
Thank you.
Kim, thinking of a memoir, a piece of creative nonfiction like The Only Kayak versus creation of this fiction, how's it different for you as an author?
Oh, much. Writing a memoir is very personal. You're bearing your soul, your own soul. It's about you, yourself, the writer. It's like, the comparison would almost be like saying, to be a good memoirist is like, maybe let's say that's a good public speaker. To be a good fiction writer is to be a good ventriloquist.
Hmm.
Right. So you're speaking through the world and views and points of view of other people. So it's much different.
Is it easier or harder?
I think it's harder.
Fiction?
Yes. And it's harder to get published.
How is it harder?
To write it?
Yeah.
Because you're being a ventriloquist. You know,
sure.
I mean, public speaking in itself is difficult and good nonfiction writing, but fiction is, first of all, it's a drug. You are completely inventing worlds and people and giving them life. It's like, you know, young Frankenstein, he's alive! It's alive! You know, and here, the other thing too is with Jimmy Bluefeather, my main character is a 95-year-old Tlingit Norwegian canoe carver. I'm not Tlingit, I'm not Norwegian, and I'm not 95. A tremendous challenge. So I just tried to ground the book as much as I could in cultural respect and compassion and love. Deep love for each other and for the country.
If somebody was going to take something from this novel when they put it down, what do you hope that would be?
Don't die before you're dead.
All right.
Stay passionate.
Okay. Kim's going to be reading tonight and signing books. Are you going to read as well tonight?
I'll read a little bit, tell some stories, intersperse it. You know, the book has a lot of humor in it. I might touch on some of that. We'll see. I'll feel the audience.
How long have you been working on this one in particular?
I worked on this book for 12 years.
Wow. It must be very fulfilling.
Very fulfilling to have it out. And the publisher loves it. It's their darling. So it's not a big New York publisher. It's one of 80 titles to come out in the fall of 2015. It's a publisher out of Portland, Oregon. This is their one piece of fiction, and it's their darling. And so my publicist, it's great to work with her.
Great. Kim, thank you for coming in today. Are we missing anything? Anything else you want to share?
No, Scott, you look good today.
Oh, so do you, sir. We'll see you tonight, 5 o'clock at the Hearthside Nugget at the Nugget Mall. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
All right. We'll see you then.
Thank you.
Bye. Get this going here.
And here is the Writer's Almanac from Monday. It's the 28th of September, 2015. 1912, on this date, W.C. Handy published his Memphis Blues. He didn't invent the blues, but he brought it to the attention of a wider public. He'd been living in Mississippi, the town of Clarksdale. W.C. Handy wrote, "I saw a lean, loose-jointed Negro plunking a guitar. He pressed a knife on the strings of the guitar and repeated the line three times. The tune did stay in my mind." And so he put it in sheet music form, W.C. Handy. Three chords, the tonic, the subdominant, the dominant sevenths, and he wrote the Memphis Blues, and then the St. Louis Blues, his follow-up, which sold a million copies of sheet music. It was on this day in 1066, William the Conqueror of Normandy arrived on British soil to defeat the British in the Battle of Hastings. And on Christmas Day that same year, he was crowned King of England in Westminster Abbey. He brought French with him, which combined with Saxon and Old Norse to give us the language that we know today. The Saxons had the word house, the Normans gave us the word mansion. It's the birthday of Kate Douglas Wiggin, born Philadelphia, 1856, who wrote Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm, many other novels as well, and also started the first free kindergarten on the West Coast in San Francisco. Kate Wiggin, who said, "Every child born into the world is a new thought of God, an ever-fresh and radiant possibility." And it was on this day in 1928 that the Scottish bacteriologist Alexander Fleming looked into a petri dish in his laboratory in London, noticed a blue-green mold growing, which was killing the staph bacteria that he'd been cultivating in that dish, and he called the mold penicillin. It was a serendipitous discovery of what became a miracle drug. Fleming had left the petri dish out by accident instead of putting it away, and then he'd gone off on holiday for a couple of weeks. But it was still a long way away from making penicillin the world's first effective antibiotic. They first had to find a way to purify the mold and then to mass produce it. And it took a team of Oxford scientists, a Rockefeller Foundation grant, and more than a decade of experimentation to make the strain of penicillin that would become the amazingly effective, life-saving antibiotic that it is today. Here's a poem for today by Sarah Frawley, entitled What I've Lost. A taste for southern comfort, umbrellas, two in a week when I was down to $8 in the bank halfway to payday, and rain in the forecast, tail end of a hurricane that blew through Cuba, kissed the coast of Florida, and ricocheted into Philly, where its gray buttocks of sky squatted over us for days. I tied a garbage bag, turban-style, swanned past the row of four-star restaurants on Walnut Street, imagining I was a 40s movie queen shooting a scene on a wet set. Next payday, I dropped $70 on a steak and a bottle of rosé, something French and unpronounceable, curly, on the tongue. The sun was out. I forgot about rain and sweet whiskey thick in my throat. What I've Lost, poem by Sarah Frelai, from her collection Sad Math, published by Moon City Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory and problem-solving through online games, Lumosity.com. And by Staples, with technology products, copy and print shipping, and other solutions for businesses of any size. Learn more at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, make more happen. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Support for programming comes from the Capital City Weekly, focused on arts, culture, and entertainment in Southeast Alaska, with distribution at community retailers throughout the region. Information at capitalcityweekly.com.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, September 28th, 2015. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 21 minutes after the hour. And joining me now in the studio are folks. We're going to be talking about Alaska's fiscal future and a forum here at Centennial Hall on Wednesday. Mr. Bruce Botello, Pat Race, and Cindy Spaniers, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Scott.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here. So Alaska's fiscal future is not looking that great, it sounds like.
Well, if one talks about looking at the next decade, the answer is we have incredible challenges before us. I think there are a few people that are unaware of the budget gap that we have, given the combined price of oil today and its dramatic decline. And coupled with our drop in production. So the combination has created a fiscal gap between what we're actually bringing in and what we're expending of roughly $3.5 billion. And the bad news is that's not a one-shot deal. That is, as we look forward, a dramatic gap that continues for the next couple of years. Well, certainly it goes on quite beyond that if we don't do anything about it. Fortunately, we've had two budget reserves that we've been able to draw on to help fill that gap, but it is being quickly drawn down.
Okay.
Yeah.
All of you sort of wear different hats in the community, business-wise or politically, but you're just here as concerned citizens. Is that right?
Kind of. I went to this fiscal forum in Fairbanks that the governor put on and learned a lot about this issue. I've been kind of following it. I do political satire and have been accidentally learning about the government while making fun of it. And it's just really apparent that we have a problem, that we're spending a lot, vastly more than we have, and we're going to just chew through our savings in a couple of years, and it's not going to be pretty.
That's the voice of Pat Race, by the way.
Oh, yeah. So this is a lot of people who see that problem, who recognize that it's a problem, and are getting together to talk about it and talk about potential solutions. And there are a lot of different approaches, and there's a lot of resistance to some of them.
Sure. Cindy, you want to start by giving us a little outline on what Wednesday's going to look like?
I will, thank you. The forum begins with Pat Pitney, who is the state's OMB director, and she is just brilliant when it comes to breaking down the budget and the revenues and how it all matches together. The budget is not always that easy to understand when you look at our obligations and things which we have to pay according to the Constitution, whether it's the PERS and TERS funding or whether it's education and so on. So she'll give an outline of all of the state's expenditures as well as the revenues. Following Pat will be a panel of four different people. They all have excellent backgrounds when it comes to addressing economics and the state's fiscal plan. They include, and you'll see some familiar names here, Jim Calvin of the McDowell Group, Larry Persily, who was a Juneau resident before taking on the Alaska Gas Line projects on behalf of the federal government and so on, and he's working for the Kenai Borough now. Greg Erickson, many of you know him from the Alaska Budget Report and OMB, and Brad Keithley, who's from Anchorage and does a blog with these issues. All four of them will have slightly different perspectives in terms of how important state spending is to the economy or whether or not this or that revenue source would be more helpful or hurtful. So I think we have a real educational group here.
In addition to you three, who else has helped organize and sponsor this event?
Well, there, quite a few people.
We've had a group of about 15, 20 people who have been active at various stages in getting this event together. Many of them participated in the governor's fiscal sustainability summit that Pat referred to that took place in Fairbanks in June, and others have just been active members of the community who have been anxious to engage in the discussion, even though they were not participants in Fairbanks.
Yeah, the scale of this problem is pretty large. It's going to affect all of us here in Juneau and in Alaska. And I think that this is a really good opportunity for people who maybe don't know a lot about it to come and learn a lot about it all in one place. There are a lot of different perspectives being presented, and there's a lot of information being presented. And there's a really great fiscal model that the state put together, Department of Revenue put together, that people are going to have an opportunity to sit down and fiddle with. So you can actually see, it's a lot easier at least for me, it's a lot easier to see what impact different things have on our state budget when you're looking at like a revenue model rather than when you're just talking about it. So to sit down and look at like, oh, okay, that's going to actually not change anything by implementing that or wow, that has a huge effect. And to fiddle with the settings and you know, increase different taxes or whatnot.
I think one thing that's important to point out as well, this event is not designed to come to any specific resolution in terms of here's the package that's going to solve the day. And in fact, our speakers reflect, I think, a range of political perspectives, some who believe that government needs to be drastically reduced and re-engineered, others who believe that while some cuts should take place, our focus needs to be on generating revenue through broad-based taxes. But we're hoping to stimulate people's thought and with the view that if the public is aware of the situation, they're going to be in a better position to give permission to our elected officials to make decisions, make the hard decisions, and to make them soon. I think we all share the view that the longer we postpone making those decisions, the fewer options we have and the more drastic the outcome.
You mentioned, so the event officially starts at 6, right? But starting at 5:15, there will be sort of a revenue model tutorial. Talk more about that?
Yes. Cindy's already made reference to the fact that there is a model that's been developed by the Department of Revenue that allows one to play with various options. And we're setting aside a room, and officials from the administration will be there to allow people to work through, get hands-on with the model. People can drop in any time between 5:15 and the conclusion of the program at 9 o'clock. And we're encouraging people to do that.
Okay. not to put you on the spot, but are there any consensuses coming out about what we need to do?
No, I mean, I think this is part of working towards building consensus. I think the idea is to throw a lot of stuff at the wall and see what sticks. We have several people that have several different approaches, and there are there are pros and cons to each of them. There's not one magic solution. No matter what we're going to do, it's going to be tough. We just have to decide what kind of tough we want.
And I would make one other plug. We will have all three members of our legislative delegation participating in the event, and we're actually calling on them towards the end of the evening to give their view on what they think the art of the possible is, and they have that dialogue as well. So they are a key part of this presentation, and more importantly, they're going to be a key part of the ultimate solution.
You've answered this, I think, to a certain extent, but what kind of person is going to benefit from going to this? Cindy?
Oh, I think every single voter, everybody who has children in school, everybody who's getting that first job, everybody who's attending the university, every homeowner, every single person will benefit from this because we are all going to be impacted. There's just no way around it.
Okay.
Yeah, anyone who wants to stick around Alaska might want to have an idea of what it's going to look like in 5-10 years and be a part of that conversation.
Is there a cost for this event?
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, there will be child care. So please come. Don't let anything hold you back.
And probably 6 to 9, what are you thinking?
The actual program will run from 6 to 9 p.m., okay. And we're going to be fairly rigorous about starting on time and ending on time.
All right. This forum is Wednesday night at Centennial Hall, starts at 6. If somebody wants more details, where should they go or who should they call?
Good question.
Yeah.
Since we're a volunteer group, I'll offer my telephone number, and that's 364-2334.
Okay. Bruce Botello, Cindy Spaniers, Pat Race, thank you all for coming in today, and thank you for helping organize this forum on Wednesday night, 6 p.m. at Centennial Hall. Anything you'd like to add before we go?
Thanks for having us here, and I just hope to see a lot of community members out at the event.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, it's only money, it will go away. It's always changing pockets, and it'll get back to mine someday. But it's only money, and it will go away. Talking about you, baby, talking about your lying, cheating ways. I'm not talking about you, baby, I'm talking about your lying, cheating ways. I don't care about the money, it's half yours anyway. But it's only money, only money will go away. Go away. It's always changing pockets. It'll get back tomorrow someday. It's only money. Only money. It will go away. If you don't want to be with me, then better find yourself a better hand. If you don't want to be with me, babe, you better find yourself a better hand. And when you spend all our money, you can just spend everything that he can bring. It's only money, all your money will go away, go away. It's always changing pockets, it'll get back to mine someday. Money, money, it will go away. Got a ticket, you ought to go and buy one.
pockets, but it'll get back to mine someday. There's only money, it will go away, away. There's only money, it will go away.
The Alaska Folk Festival and KRNN proudly present Folktoberfest, October 2nd and 3rd at the Rockwell Ballroom. Six bands and two nights of music, dancing, food, and good cheer. Featuring the Anna Lynch Band, Todd Grevey and Cold Country, the Great Alaska Bluegrass Band, and other local favorites. Enjoy three bands each night at this all-ages event. All proceeds benefit the Folk Festival and KRNN. Tickets available at the Jack, Hearthside, and at akfolkfest.org.
You're listening to A Juno Afternoon here on Monday, September 28th, 2015. Scott Burton, your host. It's about, 36 minutes after the hour, and I've been joined in the studio now by director of Othello, Tom Robinault. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Thank you.
And also Desdemona, Kat Woodkey. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
All right. So we've talked to you guys a couple times. Where are you right now in the play?
We're the last weekend's coming up, yeah. And we start Wednesday, the 30th of September, and we have our last performance on October 4th, Sunday. And Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday are at 7:30, and on Sunday it's 4 o'clock matinee. So we have a good finish coming up.
Last chance before you go to
Anchorage. Last chance.
Are you taking this to Anchorage as well?
We are, and actually this will go to Anchorage, and it'll play there for 3 weeks. Normally we do 2 weeks, but that will be a three-week performance. Also, we've been doing student matinees, and we have another student matinee on Wednesday as well. So the actors have been are primed and ready to go. They've had plenty of goes at this, so yeah.
All right, Kat, you're in from, did you say Milwaukee?
Yes.
All right, how's Juno treating you and the Perseverance scene?
It's been wonderful. I'm so grateful to be here, and it's been really fun going out on the town and meeting all the people who've seen the show so far and hearing their excitement about it and different takes on what the story's all about. So, yeah, it's been a very welcoming community here.
All right, and will you tell us about your character, Desdemona?
Yes, Desdemona is from a wealthy political family, and she elopes at the beginning of the play with Othello, who is the Moorish general, and winds up following him to Cyprus, where they're going to war with the Turks, and kind of becomes enmeshed in Iago's plot to bring Othello down.
Remind us of Iago.
Iago is the most charming, lovable, terrible villain in Shakespeare. even Desdemona is won over by his charm and never suspects that he's up to no good behind the scenes.
what's been your biggest challenge with Desdemona? What's been the hardest part to bring out about her, would you say?
Wow, well, we've talked a lot about how they're actually three different Desdemonas. There are times when she's almost a child and very naive, and other times when she is loving her new freedom and sort of almost becoming a first lady type character. They call her the general's general in the play. And I think all the actors have loved and been challenged by the kind of really quick, fast-paced changes in the play, switching from one high passion to the next at the drop of a dime.
So I know you all work very hard before the play begins, rehearsing, talking, researching, and then the play starts. How does a play start, or how does it change? How does it evolve even after it's opened? Have you seen that happen with this?
Yeah, well, they get more comfortable and they begin to find things on their own. Not to say that they don't do that in the rehearsal process, but now that there's no stop and starting during rehearsals, and that every time you have one chance at it, that they go, and this is a good group of actors because they really trust their instincts and they really go for things. And a show on, if you go to a Wednesday show, this is upcoming Wednesday, the show will be different on Thursday. And that's the beauty of live theater. And that's what's great about having these kind of actors is that they bring that. And that's what makes live theater live theater. That's what makes it so great. Is because they really, they take it and they play with it, and it keeps it fresh and new. And I say more than most plays that I've directed, this has been the case for this show. And I think that's why we're getting such a positive response and all positive, but different takes on the production.
Kat, what's that been like for you inhabiting, you know, Desdemona for this long? Have you learned anything? I mean, master writer Shakespeare, what's that been like? You must get to know the
It's great, so and we just visited a class of seventh graders who saw the show, and we were telling them that the homework never really stops, that you keep looking at your script with fresh eyes every day, and the great thing about Shakespeare is that you can open your script years after doing a production and find some new little nuance or meaning that you never really saw before. And I think Tom's right that once we get to the point where we really trust ourselves, we can just let go in the moment, and you know, you really are finding the words as if you're saying them for the first time, even though they've been said so many times before.
Sure. Do you have a piece from the play you can share with us?
Yeah, there is a song that Desdemona sings toward the end of the play that comes from a maid of her household who was betrayed by her lover, and so she sings a song from her past.
And this comes at a time where Othello's acting strange towards Desdemona. This is after Iago has planted the seed into Othello's mind that she may be having an affair with Cassio, another character in the play, and that's what's driving Othello mad with jealousy. When that uncertainty hits in this scene between with Desdemona, she reverts back to almost this childlike way, and she sings this song that she remembers hearing from the maid, which is about that her love betrayed her and bad things have happened. So she goes into this song.
Lucy Peckham wrote
Yes.
the music for it. The poor soul sat singing by a sycamore tree. Sing all a green willow, her hand on her bosom, her head on her knee. Sing willow, willow, willow. The fresh streams ran by her and murmured her moans. Willow, willow, willow.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Tom, can you give us the details again about this last weekend?
Yes, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, 7:30 p.m. Sunday, October 4th is our last performance. That's at 4 p.m. We also have be on the lookout on Facebook. We have this. We've been really trying to gear up our social media this year, so we have a special Wednesday social media promo. There's a code that's floating around on Facebook to get discounted tickets. We've got the last weekend before we take off for Anchorage. So if you haven't seen it and you want, or if you want to see it again, like a lot of people have, which has been very encouraging, this weekend's the last one to get the tickets, and they're starting to go. So get them when you can.
Sounds good. That's the voice of director Tom Robinault, and you also heard Desdemona or Kat Woodkey. Thank you both for coming on the show. Are we missing anything?
I think that's it. The next show up is Sweeney Todd.
All right. Yeah. Thanks for coming in, you two.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah. I'm going to play a tune now by Martha Redbone, and she's playing this Wednesday night at JDHS at 7 p.m. You can get tickets at thejack.org.
Support comes from the Augustus Brown Swimming Pool, offering HydroFit every Tuesday and Thursday from 6:30 p.m. until 7:30, Aqua Aerobics Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. until noon, and Stretch Aquatics Tuesdays and Thursdays from 11 a.m. until 11:45. Fall swim schedules are now available online at juno.org/park/rec/pool. More information at 586-5325.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, September 29th, 2015. Scott Burton, your host. And now with me in the studio is Marjorie Hamburger. She is the curator of public programs at the City Museum. Welcome to the show, Marjorie.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's nice to have you. So it's fall, isn't
it?
Fall time at the museum.
Yeah, it's time for the locals to come back. We've had a fun summer with tourists, of course, and the visitors are always great. But now it's kind of we're transitioning into local time.
What's fall look like at the museum?
Well, we've been closed this week, but we're going to reopen in a big way on Friday and have our first Friday. We kind of put those on hiatus over the summer, so we'll have a first Friday opening with some new exhibits. And this fall, we've got a couple exhibits opening up about disasters, which is kind of interesting. One of them, there's kind of going to be a stagger to them, so one won't actually show up till mid-October, which is a traveling exhibit of artwork by artists from all over the state who have responded to the theme of disasters in their community. It was actually an exhibit that the Valdez Museum put on to honor or to commemorate the 1964 earthquake and tsunami that really impacted that community. So that's a show of artwork. So that'll be on display, but not till sort of mid-October, and we'll do a big splash for that for the first Friday in November. But we have a companion exhibit that's about disasters in Juneau using historical photographs from floods and landslides and fires and things that have happened over the last 100 years or so here in Juneau.
All right.
And that's going to open on this Friday.
Okay. Okay. What are your hours like in the fall?
So in the fall, we go a little shorter with hours. We're open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. And the other nice thing about the fall for locals is we work hard with community members and organizations to underwrite the cost, so admission is free starting this Friday, and that'll be that way through April. And I have to give a little shout out to Alaska Pioneer Igloo Number 6, who are underwriting October, so we thank them for their support for that. And I also wanted to point out that we have actually two other locations now where we put on exhibits. One has been going on now for a little while, which is at the Douglas Library in that lobby area. When you're going into the building, they've got some wonderful cases, and we've been putting some satellite exhibits up there, and there'll be a new one opening up also this in this next week, which is a mini version of an exhibit we had on display last year called Ordinary Things, Extraordinary Tales. So we're going to have that over there, and people should put on their calendars October 24th, because we're going to do a really fun event, a pop-up museum, where people can tell their own stories about objects over there. Yeah. And then the other new satellite one is when the Valley Library opens, which I think is October 5th. Is that right? Something like that?
Mm-hmm.
So they've got some nice cases at the new library, and we'll also have that as a satellite exhibit. And we're going to do a mini version of the exhibit we had on, not this summer, but the summer before, The Empty Chair. So that'll be out in the valley.
And what inspired these pop-up and satellite museums?
Well, the satellite museum was inspired when the museum and the library joined forces as a department, which happened about a year ago. So we've been looking for ways to collaborate and support one another in our mission. And they've got these nice cases and nice people to work with, so that's where that came from. And then the pop-up museum idea is something I've actually played around with a little bit, mostly with kids in some programming I've done. But I really want to move that out into the community. And it fits really nicely with this Ordinary Things, Extraordinary Tales concept, where the idea that objects contain stories just by virtue of where they came from or how we've used them or how history has impacted them. And we've all got that stuff in our pockets or our drawers or sitting on our shelf. And so it's an opportunity. It's kind of like a community show and tell where people can come and put those objects on display. We can mount an exhibit in about 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and then we can enjoy it and we can have some refreshments and we can do that sort of show and tell thing.
Okay. What else is on your radar?
All right. What else do I want? I want to make sure people know that if they're interested in exhibiting at the museum, if they're an artist or an arts group or an arts organization that has a concept for an exhibit and want to present that to the City Museum, we are accepting applications, and those are due by the end of October, October 31st. And the exhibits would be mounted sometime during the 2016-2017 season. We've got a couple of months in there with some open slots, and we're looking for some new ideas. So if people want to learn about that, they can go to website, or they can call us up or stop by, and we can talk a little bit more and give them the application material. So this is the time.
Is there an idea that you could share with us, something that you might be looking for? What should people be thinking about?
Well,
a framework?
They should think about who we are, that we're the Juno Douglas City Museum. So something that fits with telling the story of our community in some way. So we've got, for example, some wonderful artists, but maybe if the body of work that they've done doesn't necessarily relate to Juno, you know, they took a wonderful trip to Europe, for example, and did these great paintings, but they're about, you know, European capitals, or, you know, that might not be appropriate. But if they've done something that has to do with, you know, reflecting something about this community, then that would be what we're looking for.
Sounds good. And the application materials you said are on the website, which is?
Actually, you can either Google, you know, Juno Douglas City Museum, or it's actually juno.org/museum, and look under exhibit opportunities for that.
And in the meantime, you can come to First Friday.
First Friday, this Friday.
What time does that start?
4:30 to 7 will be open. We'll have refreshments. We will have kind of scary photos of disasters, but they've all finished. And there'll be a couple of new things, too, that people will discover. We've been reworking some of our general history gallery, and even I don't quite know what that's going to look like until the next couple of days. There's been a busyness of moving some old cases out and some new things in, and changing that up a little bit, and that's going to be an ongoing process over the next year. So this will be kind of the first peek at how that's going to be transformed. And I'm looking at my notes to see if I forgot anything really critical. And I think I kind of got it.
All
at least
right.
For this month. We got more stuff in November, but I'll save that.
Yeah, come back and see us. Marjorie Hamburger, she is the curator of public programs at the City Museum. Thanks for coming in today.
Okay, thanks for having me.
We'll see you at First Friday.
All right, great.
Thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon. Tomorrow on the show, we'll talk with Martha Redbone, performing in Juno on Wednesday night at the Juno Douglas High School at 7 p.m. And we'll get the details about upcoming classes at the Learning Connection. Clint Farr will be here to highlight his new book, Beers of the North. We'll talk with Colette Costa about Wildlike, a new Alaskan film showing at the Gold Town. And Floyd Dryden principal Jim Thompson and DZ Principal Molly Yerkes will be here to talk about the Think Kindness program. Those interviews, Writers, Almanac, Bird Note, Music, and more live at 3 on KTOO News and repeated at 4 on KRNN and online via KTOO.org. The weather, it's currently 56 out in Gustavus, 56 in Huna, 54 at the Juneau Airport. And the forecast tonight calls for rain, lows around 51. There is a flood watch from Tuesday morning through late Tuesday night. And the forecast for Tuesday, windy, rain, heavy at times, highs around 54. Wednesday, rain likely, highs around 50. And Thursday through Friday, partly cloudy. Thanks again for tuning in to a Juneau Afternoon.